Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem, he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Got static on the brain, out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of Jughead's Basement, featuring the 1999 release of the Lillington's second full-length studio recording, Death by Television. Released on my very own short-lived record label, Panic Button, co-owned with Ben Weasel. The Lillington's, or as I like to refer to them as, the boys from Wyoming, had a short but intense career from 1995 to 2001. And then, about 7 years later, they rejoined in the studio only to put out one more record, their fourth and last full-length studio recording, The Too Late Show. Their influences have been subtle but long-lasting, and to me, they put out some of the most genuine, melodic punk music to have been released within the whole small but mighty pop-punk scene. I hope to show that this band from small towns in Wyoming had helped, along with a small handful of other bands, to reinvigorate and reinvent a unique take on the simple yet elusively difficult to construct music of the often insular and stultifying scene known as pop punk. This particular podcast has more interviews than I normally conduct. You will hear sections of a few extended interviews of Cody Templeman, Tim O'Hara, and Corey Lawrence of the Lillington's. You will also hear a few sections of shorter interviews of fans, label owners and producers, Mass Giorgini, Dan Lumley, and Fat Mike. And as always, these interviews will be interspersed with original pieces. A few of my good friends have spent much time contemplating the effect of Death by Television on their lives, and they have all chosen specific songs that spoke directly to them. These pieces, first and foremost, are each writer's individual takes on how a specific song has inspired them. You will hear truths, fictions, personal tales, lyrical analytics, and biographies. And also, as always, this program will be dictated by the order of the songs that appear on the album that is being featured. And now, with no further ado, Death by Television. What is the Lillington's?
I guess Lillington's would be something different. If you ask Cody, Corey, myself, everyone would probably answer something different. So, to me, the Lillington's were three guys in Wyoming that stumbled upon some great punk band and wanted to do what they were doing. Wyoming's behind the times as far as trends and stuff. There's not a whole lot to do there. The town I lived in didn't even have a McDonald's. We didn't have any fast food restaurants. You know, we had the high school. We had gas stations. There was nothing. There was no commercialism there, really. You know, the Lillington's was three guys that really wanted to get outside of Wyoming and play music that we enjoyed, that we loved. There wasn't like a whole lot of outside presence. We wrote what we wanted to without having to worry about any outside influence.
We'll be right back.
Cody Templeman?
Yeah.
Well, you sound pretty good.
Yeah, that's what the ladies tell me.
All right, let's begin.
I was born and raised in Newcastle, Wyoming. I was listening to music when I was growing up as a kid and stuff. And when I was in junior high, a bunch of our buddies thought it would be cool to start a band. You know, we had the JCPenney Christmas catalog, and they had guitars in the back of that, so that's pretty much how we did it. We formed a band before we had instruments.
And you actually got your guitar from JCPenney?
Yeah, my first one for Christmas.
You just looked at the catalog and you picked out the one that was most shiny?
Yeah, it didn't have a head on it either. It was a headless guitar.
Yeah?
Yeah, it totally was. Well, I knew Corey, like, obviously, since I was born, because he was my cousin. And he used to, like, pick on me a lot when we were in high school and stuff, and I kind of hated him.
Where exactly were you born and raised?
Newcastle, Wyoming. Same place Cody was born.
Were you close in miles or down the street?
It depended as we grew up and stuff. But eventually, at the time we did the record and both of us started playing music, he was actually less than a quarter mile down the street in a quick walking distance.
Now, he said that when he first, I think when he was growing up, you were older, so I think he was maybe a little intimidated and thought you were a little bit of a bully.
Maybe so, I guess. I think I was probably the band asshole. You know, everyone's got to have one.
Cody already played before the Lillingtons, and Tim had already played, but you learned from Cody, right? You didn't play before the band, is that correct?
You know, I got a guitar one year for Christmas, and I was still in high school, and, you know, I didn't play it that much. But, yeah, what I've learned from Cody. He basically showed me how to play, and I'm still no maestro to this day.
I don't think I'm naturally a musician. I think I love it so much that I force myself to play.
It's kind of what did it for me. You know, I got into that style of music, and at the time of my life, it charged me or something, gave me hope, got me excited. So I was like, well, I'm going to do this whether I'm capable of it or not. And I get the job done, but by no means am I a musician. Don't you see me?
Who did you meet first, and what do you remember of that experience?
First person I met was Cody. I guess it would have to be like the summer between my eighth grade year and my freshman year. My band finally kind of had our shit together. Cody played in a band called The Hybrids, and his drummer was named Shane. Shane actually lived in Douglas during our sixth grade and seventh grade year, so I knew Shane. And Shane moved away up to Newcastle, and him and Cody and another guy started their first band, The Hybrids. And so Shane calls us up and says, hey, we got this band, The Hybrids. You guys ought to come up to Newcastle and play a show with us. And so we conned one of our friends to drive us up to Newcastle, and we came in, and I met Cody. And anybody who knows Cody knows that he's got a shy, reserved streak in him, and that he really doesn't come out of his shell unless he's forced to. I was really surprised to see that he was the singer, but then I remember listening to The Hybrid, they covered Dingbat by Screeching Weasel, and I didn't know that it was a cover, and I remember them being so jealous of that song. And, you know, I was just like, going up to Cody afterwards and saying, man, I love that song, that song's so awesome. He's like, well, it's not our song, it's a song by a band called Screeching Weasel. I remember hanging out, getting drunk later that night after the show, going back down to Douglas, Wyoming. And I remember getting his phone number from Shane. Flash forward about a year later.
When The Hybrids kind of quit, Corey and I just kind of got together. And I knew Zach because I used to hang out with Zach and, like, kind of skate. He was also in, like, Corey's class in high school, so that's how they knew each other. And when we first started the band, it was, like, us three and a drum machine.
Yeah, that's what Tim had said, that he called you up. Do you remember that conversation?
The Hybrids had played with his old band, the New Degenerates. He had found out that we had broken up. He called up, and he was like, so we broke up, huh? And I was like, yeah. We got a new band going, and he said, you guys need a drummer? And I said, no, we already got one, thinking of the drum machine. So he was like, okay. And I think I let him hang up, and then I called him back again.
Were you joking with him, or did you really just want to have a drum machine and then you had to think about it?
No, I was just joking around, but I just took it too far, which happened a lot in those days.
When I asked Cody Templeman if he had any suggestions for writers to participate on this program, he mentioned a man named Tor, T-O-R, who lives in Norway. Tor is an economist. He works as a market access and governmental affairs director with a big pharma company in Oslo. He is a pop-punk enthusiast, and also he plays drums in the band The Hallingtons. So here is Tor with his take on track 3... Black Hole in My Mind.
Hey, I got the record when it came out back in 99. I can't remember exactly where I bought it or how I got it. So I guess there's a black hole in my mind right there. I do remember the feeling you get when you listen to a new record for the first time and realize that you might just got yourself a new favorite record. That doesn't happen too often. I have been listening to the Ramones for years, and of course also many of the, at the time, new bands that came out of the new pop-punk scene in the mid-90s, but this record was different. It had a different feel to it. It was sort of dark, but catchy and poppy at the same time. The lyrics were kind of strange too, science fiction related stuff that I didn't really understand at the time, but it sounded cool. Black Hole in My Mind is one of my favorite tracks of the album. It's one of the slower songs, the guitars sound really dark and a little dangerous, in contrast to Cody's bright and heartfelt vocals on top. It makes a perfect combination. I don't know anything about the background for the lyrics, but the chorus kind of gets to you anyway. And who can't relate to the line? My life has been a waste of time, I've got a black hole in my mind. At least I can. The only problem with this song is that it's almost impossible to sing along when Cody hits those high notes at the end of the song. Neste gang jeg treffer Cody skal jeg spørre om det noe dypere mening bak tekstene på skiva, men det tror jeg egentlig ikke at det 15 years on, and hundreds of pop-punk albums later, this one still stands out as one of the very best. It's a classic. It's been an inspiration for a lot of the bands in the pop-punk scene, including my own stupid band, The Hallingtons. I never got to see The Hallingtons play live, but every now and then I hear rumors about reunion shows. So, I guess I will just have to stay tuned and wait it out.
Cody had said that you brought in the title, I Saw the Ape Man on the Moon, and he thought it was ridiculous and stupid, but then once you guys started writing, the lyrics just sort of happened.
Yeah, I had the title, and then I had a line, put him on a rocket, put him on a blimp, send him up with the ape man instead of the chimp, and Cody goes, that is the stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard in my life. I said, let's use it. And that kind of started the whole record from there. I think Cody had finally had enough too, and he's like, fuck it, And I think we wrote this song in like 5-10 minutes and it was done.
There's a huge shift between Shit Out of Luck and Death by Television. Was that intentional?
You know, we were out on the Shit Out of Luck tour, and tour was a complete freaking disaster. I mean, we would show up at venues and there was either nobody there or there was no show scheduled. So we all just kind of got a little bit jaded. I told Cody, I was like, man, I said, this is not worth it. I said, we got to write music that we like and put it out. And if nobody else wants to buy it or listen to it, then at least we got our copy. That was basically the change on that tour.
What's interesting to me about that statement is that it sounds a little bit like the earlier Lillingtons were doing something that wasn't genuine to them. Did you feel that way?
No, we always loved playing, but it came to a point where pretty soon you're going to have to grow up and go get a real job again, and let's go out with a bang. So we threw everything we had into that one that we liked. And if it was never heard, we didn't care. And that's the way the band went from there on out. We would laugh when we were writing the songs, Cody and I. Like, people are going to fucking hate this shit. They're not going to fucking get it. But we're like, we like it. So let's do it.
The songs are almost all based on like these B movies. Did you just had seen a lot of these already, or did you start looking them up once you decided on the theme?
Honestly, like, I didn't even really watch that many like B movies when we did that record. We just thought that shit sounded cool. Like when we did Shit Out of Luck, like all those songs were girl songs, and like I'd never been in a serious relationship at that point. So we just said, if we're gonna lie about the shit we sing about, we might as well lie about something cool.
So how did you know some of these titles? How did they come about then?
I don't know. Like, a lot of them just kind of, we kind of made up, or like we would just hear about like certain movies and stuff. I mean, like Invasion of the Saucer Men's a pretty, you know, you don't really have to dig too deep to find that movie anywhere.
You know, a lot of them are just sort of metaphors. They're not just about these movies, probably because you didn't know them that well. Did you have to think hard on how to make a metaphor out of it, or those just sort of come into your head?
Well, we knew what we wanted to write about, and then we just like painted it up with like the sci-fi themes and stuff, but that's pretty much how the metaphors came about.
Now, are you talking mostly with Corey?
Yeah, because Corey would come up. The whole shift was like Corey came up with I Saw the Ape Man on the Moon was the title of his song, and he's like, oh yeah, that's a good title, we should use that. And I always thought it sucked. And so I would tell him, I was like, we're not writing a song about that, that's stupid, that's retarded, like everybody will laugh or whatever. And then we were just dicking around one night and wrote it in like 5 minutes, almost as a joke. And then the next day I remember listening to it and being like, wow, this kind of turned out cool.
And that sort of clicked, and then it sort of opened your mind more to not thinking it would be stupid.
And another thing too that was kind of funny was the Carlisles, like Ray and Brandon, when we would play with their old band and stuff, they always used to say that they hated I Got Abducted by a UFO because the lyrics were so stupid. We always liked that song, and we always kind of got off on the fact that they hated it because it was so stupid. Like, once that song came about, and then thinking back on that, it just kind of made sense. We're like, all right, let's just do something that sounds cool and, you know, doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
How was it decided to go to Master Genie and Sonic Iguana? Was it talked about?
There were, like, these unwritten parameters, like, everybody just knew, you know, it's like, all right, well, you know, so we're going to go there. That's just how it was. It wasn't like Corey called me up and said, hey, you know, we're going to go, we want to record with Max. What do you think about it? Oh, hell no, we're not going to do it. You know, I don't have anything to base one studio on from nothing. You know, I'm 18, 19 years old. I'm just like, oh, that dude recorded Squirt Gun and he's recorded Screeching Weasel. Okay, let's go there.
You raised all that money yourselves.
Yeah. Well, Corey was working in the oil field, and like I was working at the grocery store, and we were saving everything we made. Like we didn't have anything, you know, like we didn't have anything nice. We just took all our money and spent that, you know, just to go tour and come back broke and do it again. And that's pretty much how like we ended up doing paying for Death by Television, was just from our jobs, you know. Stay on Dragon Ass, because last night I stayed up late.
point, I was graduating from high school. Corey worked in an oil field. I was right there with him working in a coal mine. I drove a 360-ton haul truck. I drove a truck as big as a house. It was like a big dump truck, and my dump truck could fit six full-size pickup trucks in the back of it. Picture a little 19-year-old kid driving that. I could run over a car, and it would not feel any different than a regular truck running over a pop can.
You're taking the van across the country to Sonic Iguana. Did you know much about that studio?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Everybody knew about it that was into that type of music at that time, I think. That's where we decided to record it. We're huge fans of the sound that your band, Screeching Weasel, and Mask put out. So that was like our only choice at that point. If this is it, let's do what we want to do, where we want to do it, and see how it turns out.
What is your one strongest memory of being at that studio?
I'd have to say it would be like the first night after we did vocals, because we thought we were going to bang this thing out. I mean, we put a lot of records out. Well, not a lot, but several. And we'd done them on our own, kind of produced them just with the engineer or whatnot, and always did it in a fair amount of time. First night after doing vocals, and I sat down there with Cody the whole time, and he sings the first song. He's in the window there. I look over at him. I'm like, you nailed it. Because he's a good singer. I mean, he's pretty pitch perfect. And Mass looks over at him on the intercom and says, Beta? Says, Beta, bring a bucket. I think I'm going to puke. And I'm like, oh, we are screwed. And after that first drilling, we went upstairs and a little apartment up above there. And Cody just had this look like, holy shit.
This next performer has been on Jughead's Basement quite a few times now, and I always expect something a little strange and different. I very much appreciate his take on the creative aspects of this program, and I hope you enjoy his piece. His name is Greg Allen. He is the founder of the Neo Futurists. He is a writer, director, actor, and all-around good fella. So here is Greg Allen with his take on Track 6, Invasion of the Saucer Men.
A storm! There's a... here a... storm! Horrible, horrible storm! Wake me! Wake me up! Never! Never let a... let a... awake you. But isn't... isn't a... turns out, isn't... storm... horrible, it's... it's a noise. Horrible. Why? Why? Why do the children... children insist? Oh. Oh, this noise. This noise. So horrible. Ask. I ask. Music. Ha! Music, they say. Ellington. Ellington? Duke? Lellington. Lellington's horrible. Not Duke. Not the Duke. Noise. Just noise. So loud, noisy. Why? It's not... it's unnecessary. Angry. Repeating. Angry. Over and over. So loud. Angry. Invasion. Invasion? Invasion of the saucer men. What do I care? Let them come. Invasion? More like a... I suppose. Of my sleep. Invasion of my sleep. My rest. So mean. Over and over. Invasion. Invasion of saucer men? Nonsense. more, screaming just loud, over and over and over. And then, it's over. Mercy. Oh, no, not over. More. We wonder where, we wonder when, we won't know when, whatever. Invasion of the saucer men. Over and over and over. Noise again. A noise again. Youth! Youth is wasted on the young. So loud, so angry, so noisy. Oh! Oh! Then, blessed release. End. Over. Done. Done. Back. Back. I can go. Back to quiet. Head down. Soft. Pillow. No storm. No storm. Never. Never again.
And so the Lillingtons packed their bags and their few instruments and traveled all the way from Wyoming to Lafayette, Indiana, where they recorded at Sonic Iguana Studios with Mass Giorgini producing and Dan Lumley drum teching and eventually also engineering. So here to represent track number 7 is first Dan Lumley, also known as the drummer for Squirt Gun, Screeching Weasel, and the Mopes. And then you will hear from Mass Giorgini, producer, engineer, bass player from Squirt Gun, Screeching Weasel, Common Rider, and many other bands. He is also now a teacher and scholar of Cervantes' Don Quixote. So here they are, track 7, You're the Only One.
I was a drum tech, and then I engineered the drums and helped judge the performances, because back then we were doing it on ADAT tape, and you pretty much had to go with one tape on the drums. You couldn't punch in, you know, if there was a rough spot, we'd usually have to do it again. So, you know, I would listen back and help them judge. Every time they would come out with another song, I was like, I previously thought the song before that was the best one on the album, and I'm like, give me a break. They've got so many good songs on this album. It's amazing. So I just remember thinking, this is going to be a really, really good album. I just remember mostly how fun it was to hang out with the guys while they were recording. They're nice guys to boot. One of my favorite albums I've worked on.
Well, I'll tell you what. First of all, they sent me a demo tape. The songs were excellent. They're the same songs. They were played a little sloppy, and their recording was, of course, primitive. But I remember just instantly falling in love with the stuff they sent me. I just thought, this is fantastic. I definitely want to record it. But even then, I didn't get the full sense of how good they were until we started recording the album. And of course, you know, the things they noticed were like, wow, he keeps making me replay the same drum track. The bass lines were, you know, one of those minor nightmares. Let's play it, you know, a million times to try to get it exactly right. This part we might not want to put on there, but I actually played the bass in the last two songs.
Corey admitted that.
Oh, he did? Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, Corey got so frustrated by how difficult it was to play to my standards, which I thought I was being mellow for me, actually. I was being kind of mellow for me. But it was frustrating him because he couldn't quite do it. And he heard it. Like when I'd say, this is what I'm talking about. Can you hear it? And he'd say, yeah, I hear it. It's not right. You know, but they weren't used to that, of course. You know, when I'd show him what I meant, then he got it. But then he's like, Mass, you already know this song, don't you? I'm like, yeah. He goes, how many takes would it take you to play it? And I said, one. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to go upstairs to the bathroom and just fix a quick sandwich and come right back down. And if you're not done, maybe I'll give it a try, but otherwise we'll call it done. I'm like, all right. So he came back down and he says, so how'd it go? And I go, it's done.
That that's actually one of the reasons I like Corey. Both of them, they just don't care. They just want it done. They want the music done.
Yeah, there's no big ego. They were very, very humble musicians who every time I told them, you know, this stuff is brilliant, they'd go, oh, God, I don't know. It's, you know, we're just having fun. They're just fun songs. We're trying to, you know, have a good time. And that's how they approached it. They did not see the stuff they were doing as being phenomenally brilliant or groundbreaking. But I remember saying, this is excellent. This album is wonderful. There were a couple of moments where I suggested harmony things that they hadn't thought of, and they liked them. We were on Black Hole in My Mind, and I was, as he was recording the vocal, I came up with this little harmony part, and I told him about it. He goes, oh, I like that. Let's do it. I'll double it. And I'm like, no, not double harmony. Actually sing different notes. And he knew it. He just didn't know what it was called. You know, hadn't talked that way before. They didn't know that harmony was a different thing. You know, the word, I'm not talking about the concept. I mean, you know, let's face it, Cody's brilliant.
Yeah, he's like a natural talent. So, but I can see, yeah, understanding, not knowing the actual words. I mean, punk, that's what, you know, me and Ben were like that. We didn't know what we would say, third fret, fourth string, you know, like we didn't know. So it makes sense that punks that learn on their own just make up words for what it is to do it.
Yeah, but he is definitely a naturally gifted musician. He hears it, and that's another thing. The guitar tracks went rather smoothly and quickly. He's a very gifted guitar player, too. I mean, I know he doesn't try to play ridiculously difficult parts, but everything he plays pretty much perfectly. He's got very good rhythm and very good control of his fingers. His voice is fantastic, and he's got an incredible range and very good pitch and just wonderful sensibilities of how to write a melody. And I think that came through, and I remember being blown away during the session of how well it was going. And I, of course, you know, the poor guys not being used to me being so nitpicky, but we got along well. They never got angry at me. They were very kind, very sweet. But I remember I told him by the end, I said, you know, I know you guys were going to put this out on your own, and that was your plan. I don't think you guys should put this out on your own. I think they go, well, we probably could, though. And that's what we were thinking originally. And I said, you know, I know I can find a label for this. This is brilliant. I'll put my, you know, every ounce of my passion into trying to convince someone, too. And I said, I mean, right away, I can tell you, I think both Fat Mike and, you know, Ben and John at Panic Button would, I think both those two labels would be thrilled to put out this album. They couldn't believe that I would say that. And I said, I'm not just saying it, I really mean it. And so I sent off the copies of the cassette, I remember. And I remember that Ben replied and said he liked it. And then I talked to Fat Mike the same day, and he said, no, Mass, you know, I think it's pretty cool, but I just got to pass. You know, I don't know. I'm torn, but nah, I think I got to pass. I'm like, all right. So I went and I talked to those guys, and they said, well, it's okay. You know, we've already talked to Ben, and we want to do, you know, with Ben and John. You know, we already gave our word. Next day, Fat Mike called me back. I can't get these songs out of my head. You know, I keep thinking Neil Armstrong's going to take the banana away and the Black Hole in My Mind. And no, I was wrong. It's still in my head and I can't get it out. I've got to do this album. And I go, well, they already gave their word to do this with Panic Button. He goes, since yesterday? And I said, yeah, since yesterday. He goes, well, they just gave their word. I mean, maybe they could change their minds. I'm like, these guys are not like that. They're not your standard little punk kid trying to go for the best deal. They're just very sincere and they believe in their word. I just don't think they're going to back out on it. I really don't. And he says, well, will you tell them? And I go, I'll tell them. Sure, I could tell them that. I don't find that to be in any way wrong. In fact, I think it'd be wrong not to tell them. So yeah, I called them and I said, well, this is the deal. And they go, yeah, Mass, that's very nice of you to call. And I'm very glad to hear that he liked it and everything. And I wouldn't want him to think it's because, you know, I don't respect him or I'm trying to get back for him turning it down the first time, but I don't think I can do that. But let me talk to the boys and call you back. And of course, they call me back like 20 minutes later and they all said, no, we gave our word. We want to stick with our word, and that's very nice. And we're glad that he likes the album. I mean, here's like one of the most powerful punk rock labels in history, right? And they're like, no. And I just find that one of the very charming things about the band. They're very sincere. They speak from the heart. They don't think their music is that important. They enjoy it. They're having fun, and they want to do what they like. And isn't that what we should all be doing?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I've been lucky. I've been able to be involved in some very special albums, but, you know, Lillington's is right up there. I mean, if I had to name a best one, it'd have to be one of them I'd consider. I wouldn't want to have to name a best one, but but I can't deny that is a very special album, and it's fun to listen to. It's just so much fun, and it's so good. It just has all the right spirit of a very positive-feeling punk rock album without ever being corny or cheesy. It can talk about silly things without descending into stupid, and it can talk about dark concepts without sounding too pretentious. It's a pretty magical formula, and it worked only for them because they are the Lillingtons.
The next track is written and performed by a newcomer to Jughead's Basement, Sarah Ramone. Sarah is a mom, a vinyl addict, traveler, and extremely passionate supporter for the continuing of music she believes in. You can follow her column on the Italian/American webzine called I Buy Records at buyrecords.blogspot.it. Now here is Sarah with the 8th track on Death by Television, I Need Some Brain Damage.
One of my passions, aside from being completely music obsessed, is reconstructing band shirts. I've spent many hours at my sewing machine, making my collection of them look a lot more personalized and feminine. I love wearing them all, too. There's my ridiculous amount of Ramones, my favorite Italian bands, and my Dan Vapid and the Cheats ones, just giving a few examples of what you'll usually see me wearing.
1, 2, 3, 4, I'm gonna die. 1, 2, 3, 4, I'm gonna die, child.
But there is another one that falls in the rotation on a weekly basis, and I treasure it greatly. It's frayed from the years of washing and haphazard cuts I initially made to it. The design is cracked, and there's even a small bleach mark that I color over with a Sharpie when it starts to show. I'll continue to wear it even in that shape forever, or at least until it disintegrates anyway. It's my Death by Television shirt, and it gets a lot of wear because that's such a significant album to me. This is an album where the first memories of hearing it are clear as day. It was one of those moments where, if I had to give it only one word for descriptive purposes, it would be hallelujah. At the end of the 90s, things were kind of starting to shift in a direction I wasn't so crazy for as far as pop punk goes, but this band was always unique and different. They obviously had a Ramones influence that was easy to pick up on, but it was clever, it was well executed, and it was overwhelming. Not some half-rate clone so many bands that try to pull this off usually produce either. Lots just fail miserably, but not this band. The Lillingtons play in a way that you hear these influences, but it's their own sound. I could listen to it a million times, which I may have at this point more than 10 years after, and I get the same experience every time. With every release this band did, it was always a first moment feeling in listening that I think to myself, there just may be hope. Someone gets it. I adore the entire track list too, but in just picking one that stands out definitely, it's I Need Some Brain Damage. Right from the first second, those guitar riffs start thundering through and they're engraved in my memory. The lyrics play out well with the frustration of everyday life with the line of don't want to go to work at the Dairy Queen that made me laugh and smile when I first heard it because as a teenager I actually worked at one of those places at my first job and I hated it there. Little things like that paired with the music my heart believes in most backing it. Cody's vocals that were just a welcome and fast addition to my all-time favorite vocalist list and the genuine simplicity made it so easy to relate to. Everything clicks together in that song and I fall for it instantly. Time may have flew by after, and the Lillingtons may be no more at this point, but it's songs like I Need Some Brain Damage that stay in my mind with great fondness. They connect to who I am, and they make me feel normal. Pop punk, or at least what's popular with the masses these days, didn't take the turn I was hoping for necessarily either when I first listened to Death by Television. But because it's out there, my hope keeps going for this sound. Just maybe somewhere in a basement in some small town. There's a group of kids getting ready to turn the tide once more on music, with another originally wonderful take on what I believe in as a punk rocker. Until then, though, the music stays with us, and right now as you're listening to what I have to say, that's exactly the shirt I have on.
Was there any kind of different recording approach? You know how Mass is pretty anal and works towards perfection. Was there a big change in how that was recorded from your previous stuff?
Oh yeah, we I think we originally booked like 6 days, and before we went in, like we practiced those songs like a shit ton, and we were just it's pretty funny. Like it was real eye opener because we were kind of joking around before we got in there. We're like. Before we would record everything live, basically, and then overdub like guitar leads and like record a second guitar lead or guitar track, and then just, you know, overdub like vocals and backups and all the other stuff. So we were like kind of joking around. We're like, shit, 6 days. That's what are we going to do when we get done, like with the rest of the days that we have left? And yeah, that wasn't the case at all. I think we figured out that wasn't going to happen when it was like day three and we were still working on drums.
Yeah.
I remember pulling up to the studio outside, and we're just like looking at this building, and we're like, this is it? What? Are we in the right place? And I remember them checking the address, and I remember Cody walking around the one side of the building and coming back and saying, no, that door's locked or this or that. And then Max finally comes and came to the door and let us in. And I remember going through the doors and coming into the main control room. I remember going into the control room and looking up at the sides of the walls and seeing like all of our heroes' bands up on the wall. I'm dreaming. After all the hard work that we've done, and I couldn't believe that we were there in so many great bands. Matt had all of those CDs that were framed and up on the walls and stuff. It was just unbelievable. I mean, walking in there and seeing all the so many great bands on the wall, it was breathtaking. You work really hard and you walk in and you're like, all right, man, this is it. We're doing it. It's kind of like where you realize you're doing it.
Did you tour immediately for that record? And was there any difference in audience reaction from before and after that record?
Yeah, I mean, when we toured before with Shit Out of Luck, nobody showed up to the shows. So that was a major change right there. You know, there were people at the shows. The first tour we did after that record came out was with the Teen Idols. So, like, all the shows were really, really good because they were doing really well at the time. They were one of the funnest bands to tour with.
Did you feel you held your own alongside the Teen Idols?
I don't know. Like, I think a person's always more critical of themselves than anybody else. But in some ways, yeah. I know before we did that tour, we played a few shows in Wyoming with Homeless Wonders and canceled out halfway through because we realized we sucked. So we went home and practiced our asses off for that tour.
So is it hard for you to distinguish between knowing Cody then and then knowing him once you were in a band with him?
I don't think so. We knew each other well. When we were in the band, it was interesting because I remember one trip we drove all the way to Texas for one show, and it was just him and me in there most of the way. And, you know, there's like comfortable silence. Hours would go by and we wouldn't say nothing to each other. We just listened to the boombox that was up on the dash to whatever mixed cassette we had up there. I don't know. I think that's how you know somebody, if you don't have to constantly be talking. And it got to be that way with all three of us. You know, we'd go on tour and none of us would talk the whole way unless we wanted to stop or something. Whenever anybody jumped in with us and went for a little ways, they were like, you guys don't talk. Well, we're like, well, there's no need to. We already know what the other one's thinking. So what's the point? We're just comfortable.
Was there a moment where you really thought you guys gelled as a band?
Yeah, I think like right before we did Death by Television, it was definitely like the point. We would practice a lot. When Tim would come up, he would stay all weekend and we would practice for, you know, hours and hours playing the same shit over and over again.
Cody probably did. were you playing there with them with the bass when you guys were writing this, or you'd come up with lyrics? Then how would they go down?
Usually we'd start with the title, and you know, you lived like right down the street from me, so we'd chat on the phone, you know, when it was still hooked to the wall with a cord, and I was like, all right, I'll be down in about 5 minutes, and we had something good going. We knew it usually, and I'd walk down there. He had two or three guitars. He'd bust one out, and we'd both play guitars. I wouldn't play the bass. We'd just start writing it, trying to bang it out. I guess we wouldn't try. We were just kind of playing for the fun of it. I think it comes through on the record that we didn't, like, work on it. I mean, we did it because we wanted to. Sometimes Cody would write the whole song, and I can remember one time him and I were driving to Rapid City for one thing, and him and I talked this when we were on our way down to Anthrax. We're just driving to Rapid one day, and he spits it out. He's like, Phantom Maggot. And I'm like, that's fucking retarded. That's so stupid. I'm like, let's fucking do it. And he wrote the entire song, and it's great. I think it's one of the best ones on the album.
In 1999, the Lillingtons were going to call it quits, so they recorded what they felt was an album for themselves. But as one last-ditch effort, they sent it to a few of their favorite labels. Panic Button was one of them, ran by me and Ben, and Fat Records was another one, ran by you. Why didn't it end up on Fat Records?
Well, it's funny, because I listened to the tape, and I liked it, but I just kind of thought, this is, you know, standard pop punk. Kind of from Wyoming. I haven't really heard of them. They don't really have a name for themselves. And it's a decent record. So I called them up and said, yeah, I like it, but I don't really want to put it out. And then the songs just got stuck in my head. And I just kept listening to it. Like, oh, just put this on in my van, because it's pretty good. And I couldn't stop listening. So the next day I called them back and I said, you know, I changed my mind. I would like to sign you guys. And I said, well, you blew it. Because now we're on Panic Button.
Funny how quickly that turned around.
Yeah, it was a one-day thing, and it's still probably my biggest regret that I've done on Fat Records. But on the other hand, having that band not on my label was really fun, too, because then I could just enjoy them and not worry about marketing or I was going to get them bigger or what bands I was going to get them to play with. It was just, I could just listen to the record and enjoy it.
Can you pinpoint something in it that grew in you, or what about it, or specific songs?
Well, everything about it is great. I love how all the songs are on the same vibe about kitschy space themes. There's so many minor melodies that they're so great. Because pop punk or Ramones core, it tends to be really boring doing 1-4-5, where they're playing all kinds of cool stuff. And I think my favorite thing about the record is how the harmonies on a lot of the songs come in on the last chorus, which is totally genius, but it wasn't genius. Mass told me that they were out of time, so we decided just to do harmonies on the last choruses. So, it's something that I use on NoFX records quite a bit because of that Lynch's record, because of Death by Television. And they didn't even mean to do it, they just ran out of money. But, you know, that's how some of the greatest punk records of all time are made, is because they ran out of money and they just decided, oh, let's just take that take or this one. Sometimes you get magic that way.
And now, for the first time, you are going to hear my bosses and producers at Tuesday Night Hootenanny, Jeremy Corp, Sam West, and Nick Miner, contemplating, pondering, wondering, and talking about the 11th track on Death by Television, Robots in My Dreams.
Who can't relate to the lyrics of Robots in My Dreams?
Got robots in my dreams.
Any ham and egger can relate to that song.
Any ham and egger?
Yeah. Ham and egger?
Ham and egger. That's a good phrase. I like that.
Sounds like a slur.
No, that's it just means like a 9-to-5 guy. Ham and egger.
Ham and egger.
Yeah.
Haven't heard
great.
That.
Here goes the neighborhood, a bunch of ham and egger.
Jesus, almost every day I wake up and I'm like, oh, God.
work. Yeah, I love this band, especially re-listening to it now. As much as I like Teenage Bottle Rocket, like kind of hearing them grow up, being part of it, you know, because I mean, you know, I bought this record.
Oh, God. It was late 90s.
Late 90s. So, I mean, you know, I was still a baby as far as my musical tastes were concerned. And
came out on Lookout shortly before they completely fell off. You can kind of see the growth of Cody's songwriting if you go from something like that to like a more recent Teenage Bottle Rocket thing.
Yeah, it's just kind of neat to be there and watch it progress, being invested in it like that and just seeing what it turned out to be.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
what's neat about getting into people with such longevity.
Oh, yeah.
You kind of follow the growth, especially in songwriting. People who don't understand that kind of music, they hear it and they think it's really simple, but I don't think they realize how incredibly difficult it is.
Yeah, because there's a lot
to write a song that sounds so simple.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of neat harmonies and vocal work in the end of that song, too, that it's not easy. Just because you know three chords doesn't mean you can put that out.
You got to put them in the right order.
They're really good proof, the Lillingtons, how to put together a good punk song.
Yeah.
I think the Lillingtons were a perfect band for Lookout.
Oh, yeah.
Especially at that particular time because all the Lookout staples were kind of falling away. Changing of the guards took place. Might have been the last really great signing of a band that should have been on that label.
Yeah, I got into my first wave of punk bands like Green Day, Screeching Weasel, the Queers, and then with the second wave, like these guys, Squirt Gun, you know, and just, it really brings me back to when I was still finding new music I was really into.
And getting excited about it still.
I haven't heard the Lillingtons before.
Because a lot of the Lillington stuff was B-movie based.
I did hear that.
You know, a lot of monsters and robots and...
They have like a very kind of universal monsters, old sci-fi feel to that entire record. And it was another album that was produced by Master Genie. You can't really get any better a producer when it comes to that kind of music.
Oh,
that's my first time hearing that song. I enjoy it immensely.
You a fan now?
I am a fan now. I'm very pissed that no one threw me a CD. It's like, hey, listen to that.
With all the Lookout stuff you guys got me into, I figured.
I think it was on the way down for you.
Yeah, it was.
It was really late from when we would really pay attention to Lookout. It was kind of in that era where shit would slip past because everything was so hit and miss by that time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because that was Panic Button, which was John and Ben's imprint label on Lookout. It came out through Lookout, but technically it was on Panic
and then
Records.
You know, I had a real job. I had things to do than not spend my money on albums upon albums. Things fell in the cracks for me. Granted, I did have a radio show at the time, but...
You did, and this would have been perfect because this was right up the alley of what you played then.
I know. The emo scene came out, and I kind of fell on that wagon for a little while, and I think everything else just fell by the wayside.
That's when I stopped being your friend.
So now I'm a little disappointed that I missed this.
But you get to rediscover it now, and this is actually kind of perfect. Two guys that are familiar with it, and one guy checking it out for the first time.
No, I will definitely be.
You're familiar with Teenage Bottle Rocket, right? Like, you listen to that
a little bit. I haven't fully listened to an album yet either.
Well, I'll tell you what, Cody Templeman is a great songwriter, and I think you would probably love all of
it. I'm still living in the past of other things that have come out, so.
Busy revisiting Refreshment's greatest hits.
Allegiance to Panic Button wavered when the Lillingtons performed in California, and no one from Lookout Records, the label in which Panic Button was an imprint, no one showed up to their show. And yet, you were there alongside, from what I have been told, quite a crowd of band members and employees from Fat and Honest Don's. Was this purely because you all liked the band, or was there some orchestrating on your behalf of some wooing going on?
Oh, no, I don't do that at Fat Records. I mean, you know, I tell, when I'm out of town, I say, hey, can someone from the label go check out the band? But the Lillingtons, everyone at Fat Records loved them. My wife at the time flew them out to San Francisco for my 35th birthday party as a surprise. You don't do that kind of thing because we're trying to make a move. One, two!
What sort of happened when Tim left?
He was kind of like, he went on a mission, like a Mormon mission. And it's something like that he wanted to do. And there were times when we like didn't really get along with Tim that well, you know, like because Corey and I were we were super uptight, you know, way more than we needed to be. And Tim was way more happy-go-lucky, like don't give a shit kind of personality. And so like it was always kind of off-putting to us. Mm-hmm. So and I think we were kind of thinking of like getting somebody else anyway. And then he sent us a letter that said that he was gonna leave to go on this mission and stuff, and we were kind of like stoked, but at the same time it was kind of, I don't know, we always missed him. He always like brought an element to that band that, like, you know, that was never there afterwards.
Yeah, I sometimes avoid sort of talking about those things because you never know about feelings towards each other. And I know there's probably, you probably had some hard times with him, but
It seems like you guys are just the type that were just dealt with it, and you didn't. It didn't really hurt in the long run relations with him. Do you feel that you are still friends?
Yeah, and I think, like, honestly, I think with all the shit that we went through, like, with us and him, like, I think we're a lot closer now because of it, you know, because we did have those, like, fights and stuff. I don't know. There's definitely, like, when you're putting that much time, that much of your life, like, into something for that long, that's kind of, like, part of your life, you know, and he was, like, part of our life, like, you know, we were a part of his, so, and we always talk about how fun those days were and stuff, and I think it was a good thing.
You left the band.
Right. When Death Grips Television came out, we went on, you know, a handful of tours, and we were trying to do it as much as possible. And I think at one point, the side of me who missed out on all the stuff, like in high school, I feel like nowadays I'm kind of always a little bit behind as far as where any other 35-year-old man would be in his life. I'm kind of like in a place where maybe a 25, 28-year-old man would be missing out on doing things like going to parties and hanging out with friends and pursuing relationships and things like that. Got the best of me. And all honestly, for me, I know when it came time to do that channel broadcast, there had been discussion about whether to do it on Panic Button again. You know, Fat Mike was still knocking at the door and wanting the next record. And I remember going out to California and you gotta, like, to preface this, and all honestly, I was a fan of all the Fat Records music long before I was a fan of the Lookout Records music scene. NOFX and Langwagon and the Swinging Gutters and things like that. Prefacing that, when we went out to California, you know, and we were playing San Francisco, we were expecting to see the Lookout people there at our show. Now, when we get out there, not one person from Lookout Records showed up. Nobody. Nobody from Lookout had, you know, been, and I would have thought for sure, us being on Panic Button, someone would have shown some interest of coming out, at least meeting us. Fat Mike and his wife were there. Joey Pink from Lagwagon was there. All of the Swinging Gutters were there. I thought it was really awesome that all these people came out, you know, and watched our show, you know, and I'm playing our set, and I look over and see Fat Mike singing the words to our songs. Whoa, another holy shit moment. So when we got back and we're talking about Back Channel Broadcast and what to do with the record and where we should put, like, who to put it out and stuff, I honestly voted for us to do it with Fat. And then Cody and Corey, I was kind of vetoed on it and saying that it was going to come out on Panic Button again and stuff. You know, I was like, all right, well, no, you know, no big deal. You know, not a huge thing. But then it got to the point where, like, all right, so they start writing the song. And at the time, to me, the songs weren't as strong as the Death by Television stuff. And then they were hinting at wanting the drums to be even more simplistic, just hi-hat and snare. And hindsight's 20/20, because looking back, I know, like, what they were going for. But at the time, I felt like I took it the wrong way, that they were stifling my creativity or my opportunity to contribute my own parts to the songs. Well, long story short, I just told the guys I was really burned out. I was really burned out on the whole band touring and stuff, and I needed a break. And I wanted to pursue some other interests. I was really afraid of how they were going to take it. I was afraid to call Cody up on the phone and tell Cody that I didn't want to do it. You know, it wasn't like I want to quit forever, but it was I want to do something else right now. I was afraid to tell him that. Because, again, like, I'm a person that has a hard time saying no. I'm a person that hates to see disappointment in other people or to be cause of that disappointment. So I wrote a long letter to them giving my reasons why I wanted to leave the band, you know, trying to justify my departure. Then I mailed it to them. You know, I guess like a couple days later I got a call from him, you know, and I was expecting them to be upset, and they weren't upset. You know, he was like a lot more supportive. Cody was like, you know, I understand where you're coming from. You know, you got to do what you got to do. You find whatever it is you're looking for. There was a little relief off of my shoulders to know that my departure from the Wilmingtons wasn't any bad blood there whatsoever, or I hadn't caused any bad blood.
Even now, I mean, seeing all the history you guys gone through, that you guys have a pretty damn strong friendship.
I have friends, and I have good friends.
apart from those friends, I have the Lillingtons. Corey and Cody belong to their own category of friendships that there will never, ever, ever be any other person, say maybe my future wife, that would be able to have that same kind of friendship and that bond and that loyalty I have to those two guys.
This next track is conceived, written, and performed by my pal and fellow podcaster of The Hole in 30 Days. He is a Chicago-born resident, now living in the city of Los Angeles. You can find his present work and videos on Facebook under the name Uncle Funny Jokes. So here's Eric T. Roth on track 13, Caveman.
We stomped through parks when we weren't skating. Usually in packs, always swearing, doing our best to show the yuppies of Chicago's gentrifying north side we belonged and they didn't. Were we scary? No. Or maybe. After 9/11, someone on the train yelled at me because of an anti-flag t-shirt I was wearing, so we were at least pissing people off. There were scarier kids in our neighborhoods, but we stuck together and usually looked too ridiculous to fuck with. We fought in the street every once in a while, or in the park. We hit each other with sticks and had the occasional run-in with the cops. Nothing ever too serious. This was Chicago, and we were straight-edge punks and emo kids. We stayed under the radar as far as juvenile delinquency was concerned. Occasionally, a friend would say something racist or homophobic, and then other times they would quote Family Guy. Like burps and farts, the unpleasantries of everyday life are the adolescent male's manna. By the time Death by Television came out, I was headed to college. My pop punk albums and compilations stuck to the inside of their CD binders because I was listening to more important music. Modest Mouse, probably. On an album like this one, you'll find as much goofy, stupid sentiment as brilliant philosophy, if you're willing to listen. Me, I was 18. I was all grown up, looking back down on my youthful arrogance. How young and dumb. Young and dumb. I don't know how many cavemen ever lived in swampy Chicago or whatever Newcastle used to be, but there are plenty of brilliant, angry idiots stomping through towns all across the U.S., all across the world. We gather in grungy underground clubs and scribble our stories onto bathroom walls. When the music kicks on, we dance hard. Sometimes we think we've grown up, but usually we've just found a different cave. Young and dumb. Young and dumb.
I talked to Cody a lot about his shyness and him trying to work through it. Did you experience anything about him being shy or not talking?
Well, yeah. All the dudes, no one in the band talked. And I remember I took him out to Japanese food, and I'd never had anything like it. And I'm not talking sushi. I'm just talking, you know, chicken teriyaki. And I go, you never had Japanese food? And they're like, well, we're from Wyoming, and there's a McDonald's and a Denny's and a Chinese food place. So Chinese food is really the most ethnic food we've ever had.
Just a record ago, you were like, oh, this is it. Maybe we'll throw in a towel, and then here you are. Crowd's picking up a bit, and now you're doing another record. Was that difficult to you to have to deal with all that?
Yeah, I got a little messy at times there, but I don't know. I think we're pretty honest guys, and if we give somebody our word, we stick by it, whether it's right or wrong, to the end, usually. So that's kind of what we did. We wanted to see Panic Button become a great label, you know, kind of like Lookout used to be, but wasn't at that point, with good bands on it, you know, and we were all about promoting Panic Button, so that's where we stayed.
And then you joined Teenage Bottle Rocket. Yeah. That seem a natural progression for you?
Yeah, it was weird. Like, after we broke up, it was kind of nice because, like I said before, like, we would just work and all of our money would go towards the band stuff. So when we split up, it was kind of nice living regular life for a while, you know, like being able to afford nice things and shit like that. But then I got pretty depressed when we weren't doing stuff. It was cool at first, but after a while it was like something was missing, you know. And Brandon and I were always like really good buddies, and they asked me to go on a play guitar on a tour because, like, Joel, who was playing guitar with him at the time, couldn't go because he had something to do for his degree at the university. And so I went with them on that tour, and it was kind of like what you said about, like, going with us. It kind of, like, rekindled your... It was like that spark that kind of got you back into all that stuff.
Do you think Wyoming does something to you musicians? What comes out of Wyoming?
Coal.
Do you think there's any attitude in the music that you did with either band that is Wyoming grown?
I think there's definitely, like, something with being neglected of, like, a lot of shit that other people have readily available to them that kind of, it's kind of a driving force, I think, to, like, actually do something.
It seems like, even when I see you with the Teenage Bottle Rocket Boys or the Lillingtons, and why even my book I call you the Boys from Wyoming, it does seem to be important that there is some sort of friendship going on in the band, and it's not just a band. It's, am I just projecting that on that, or does that feel that way with you?
No, it's definitely there. Like, we all definitely care for each other and stuff, and if I had to be in a band with people, you know, that I didn't like, I just wouldn't be in a band at all.
And now I think that's in a sort of an extreme view on Wyoming, but I do think it's there, that, and more so than any other, if I'm stereotyping about areas, it did seem very strong in the bands that I saw that came out of that area.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's a whole lot of people who are into the same shit in the whole state, so, like, when you find somebody who's into the same stuff you like, you kind of become buddies.
What do you think you guys did that made it a special record, if you were to allow to say that it is a great record?
I don't know. I think the spirit of it, you can't fake that. And I think it shows. I think that's the only thing different that we did other than anybody else, is we put some spirit into it and wanted to do it. Didn't care if anybody heard it as long as we had our own copy. Turns out people liked it. So there's a plus.
Well, there you have it. I hope that gives you a little glimpse into one of my favorite bands and good friends, the Lillingtons. Thanks once again for listening to Jughead's Basement. Stay tuned next month when we feature a band that I've liked ever since high school, which is almost over 30 years now. Oof! We will be exploring the Feelies album, The Good Earth. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. Make sure to check out the other shows on the TNH Network right here at TuesdayNightHoot.com.